You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
G'day. We are here for this week's edition of Stick Together, the only national program focusing on union news, worker stories, and social justice issues.
This program is produced in Naarm, Melbourne, for 3CR, and broadcast across the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. On the stolen lands of the Kulin Nation, we recognise that our struggles are connected and stand in staunch solidarity with elders past, present and emerging. On today's program, we will be investigating the global attack on the working class by the ruling class. We will connect the many threads that braid our joint struggles and hear from important voices about how the fight against the drive to war is everyone's business on a planet that is facing not just a political crisis, but also an environmental crisis that is not just on the horizon, but has already arrived. The Tricontinental Institute of Social Research has just released a brand new dossier entitled The Environmental Crisis is a Capitalist Crisis, which provides a comprehensive study of the capitalist conditions which produce environmental crisis. Using an excerpt of this dossier, we will look at the tornado that has just ripped through the Ermont in Val d'Oise in France, the situation of recovery after the 2022 floods in the Northern Rivers suburbs, and finally we will hear from a CFMEU rank and file member speaking at a public housing rally to see what the effects of the environmental crisis are on the ground and how all these issues are linked together by the logic of capitalism. Beginning with a section of the Tricontinental's dossier entitled The Destruction of Life and the Logic of Capital, we will work our way down through the troposphere to the Earth's surface where we live. Quoting, climate change is the most visible and urgent aspect of the environmental crisis. Chemical pollution, loss of soil cover, ocean acidification, biome destruction, and the loss of biodiversity are also fundamental dimensions of this crisis. The environmental crisis manifests in ways that underscores its inseparability from the class struggle. We see this in the floods that devastated southern Brazil in 2024, the heat wave and then floods that hit Pakistan in 2022, leaving millions homeless while elites remained protected. The 2018 floods in Kerala, India, the 2022 flooding and blackouts in Cuba caused by Hurricane Ian, a phenomenon intensified by rising ocean temperatures, and the increasingly extreme cycles of floods and droughts in the Horn of Africa. From 2019 to 2020, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia faced heavy rains followed by devastating floods. From 2020 to 2023, these countries faced one of the longest droughts in the past 70 years, only to be hit by new floods in 2023 to 2024. These instances show that the environmental crisis is deepening. The main factor driving climate change is the high level of greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels, as energy consumption from these fuels continues to rise year after year. If we take a closer look at global emissions levels, the data once again speaks volumes. The richest 10% are responsible for nearly 20 times more emissions than the poorest 50%. Moreover, both historic and current greenhouse gas emissions are directly linked to inequality, not only between the global north and south, but also between the richest and poorest segments of the global population. According to the Global Carbon Project, the 23 most developed countries account for half of all CO2 emissions since 1850. The United States alone has emitted 24.6% of all carbon released into the atmosphere, followed by Germany, 5.5%, the United Kingdom, 4.4%, and Japan, 3.9%. The other half of emissions is spread across more than 150 countries. Recent data shows that this reality has not changed. According to a 2022 study by Climate Watch, the World Resources Institute's data platform, the 10 largest emitters are still responsible for 76% of global CO2 emissions. In 2022, China was the largest emitter of CO2, followed by the United States, India, Russia, and Japan, which would make Asia the planet's biggest emitter today. However, because the populations of countries such as China and India are much larger than those of the United States, European countries, Japan, or Australia, measured in per capita emissions, the United States is by far the world's largest CO2 emitter, with a per capita rate twice that of China and eight times higher than India's. Globally, the fossil fuel industry is the largest emitter of CO2, with roughly 100 companies responsible for 71% of global CO2 emissions, according to a Carbon Majors report published in 2017. Among them are giants such as ExxonMobil, Shell, BHP Billiton, and Gazprom. Another 2019 study by the Climate Accountability Institute found that just 20 companies have been responsible for one-third of all global CO2 emissions since 1965. Now, despite regional and national differences, what is clear is that climate change and the destruction of nature are direct consequences of the logic of capital accumulation advanced by the ruling classes. End quote. The most recent tornado that tore through Ermont just north of Paris, which ripped the roofs of many buildings off, overturned cars, and eventually blew over cranes onto nearby buildings, killing a 23-year-old worker and critically injuring several other people. Interior Minister Laurent Nunez labelled the storm one of rare intensity. However, with the frequency that these extreme weather events are happening, they can no longer be considered rare. These are the conditions that the ruling class has deemed to become the new normal, and the ones that they expect workers all over the world to deal with in the name of capital accumulation. We see the after effects of such life-shattering events much closer to home, as people of the northern rivers that lost everything in the 2022 floods, when heavy rains raised the Wilson's River to a record high of 14.4 metres on February 28, 2022, causing the deaths of five people and destroying thousands of homes. Water dramatically rose to the tops of roofs in the town centre as regular people took to rescuing their neighbours in dinghies. In the immediate aftermath, devastated communities had to brace for yet another flood the following years, and 3 years on, there are still people living in temporary pod villages. These residents of the pod villages, who were initially expected to transition into permanent housing within a few years, have been unable to do so because of the unavailability of public housing and the exorbitant costs of the rental market. The Insurance Council of Australia reported the floods as the most expensive event in history, with insurance losses totaling $5.7 billion, ranking it as the fourth most costly natural disaster globally for 2022. Many homeowners found that they could insure their houses, but that the premiums for flood protections were in some cases above $15,000 per year. And in some cases, after the floods, insurance claims were denied based on hydrologist reports concluding that damage was due to riverine flooding rather than stormwater, even when residents provided evidence of stormwater damage occurring prior to the flood peak. Neighbouring properties received different outcomes from the same insurers, which accepted stormwater claims for one property while denying it for another. The New South Wales Reconstruction Authority acknowledged that no long-term plan was in place for rehousing residents, a finding highlighted in an Auditor General's report that criticised the lack of preparedness and planning for the temporary housing response. The residents that remain in the pod villages will now be forced to pay a licence fee, marking a shift from the previous 2 years where the state covered the cost of housing the displaced residents. Another example of everyday working people forced to deal with the situations created by ruling class policymaking, and the opening up willy-nilly of every facet of life to corporate neoliberal interests, from environmental policymaking to disaster relief management and to the basic human right to have a roof over your head. We go now to the streets of downtown Melbourne on Monday the 13th of October outside the Minister of Housing Harriet Shing's office and hear what rank-and-file CFMEU member, Defend the Unions, Defend the CFMEU organiser and friend of the show Amelia give her account of the housing crisis and how she's experienced it.
For those who don't know me, I am a rank-and-file member of the CFMEU. So I work in the construction industry. Construction workers want jobs that are safe and unionised and that benefit other working class people. We want to build hospitals, we want to build schools, and we want to build public housing. Governments like our Labor government and the Liberal government before them constantly try and blame workers like us for the housing crisis, when we know that the housing crisis is a symptom of their policies. And then they get workers to carry out their dirty work for them. They don't like to get their hands dirty, do they? Often it's perceived that construction workers are really well paid and homeowners and are not affected by the housing crisis, but that's definitely not the case. Me, myself, I'm a single mum and I have to rely on the private rental market. And having gone through private rental after private rental, there is never any security in it. The conditions are abhorrent and you're beholden to the will of a real estate agent who doesn't even follow their own legislation that they're meant to follow. I've lived in houses without heating, without working ovens, with mold, with collapsing ceiling, and there's never anything done about it.
Talking about the extreme events becoming the new normal, this week also saw the long-awaited and much-hyped meeting of President Trump and PM Albanese as they signed our way into continuing the apocalyptic venture by the name of AUKUS, with Albanese saying, quote, "We are great friends and we are great allies, and this is a relationship that has been forged in the battlefields of the world. We have stood side by side for freedom and democracy, and congratulations, I must say, Mr. President, on the work you've done in the Middle East. It's an extraordinary achievement." One has to wonder about the dictionary definitions of the words being used and whether or not the world is undergoing a process of semantic inversion. I'm not sure that I would consider much of anything that Trump or Albanese have done in their terms as relating to freedom or democracy. Both have presided over some of the most draconian immigration and offshore detention policy, with the US sending the paramilitary organization known as ICE into cities to snatch people off the street and send them to mega prisons like El Salvador's Seacock complex, and in the case of Australia, deporting foreign-born detainees that it previously held in indefinite detention, dubbing them non-citizens, and who now, through a backdoor deal with Nauru, will be deported en masse, costing taxpayers $400 million with an annual payment of $70 million on top. Past agreements with Nauru have been fraught with corruption, and in just August, it was revealed that the leader of the notorious Finks Bikie gang was promised $40 million in Australian taxpayer money for security and policing. This secret deal has real-life implications for a huge number of people, opening the door to mass, without notice, deportations to harm under the powers the government gave themselves in their brutal bills passed in the late sitting of 2024, which have the potential to apply to over 80,000 people, tearing families apart and destroying lives forever, says the Asylum Seeker Resource Center, with Jana Favero, Deputy CEO of the Asylum Seeker Resource Center, saying, quote, "The Albanese government has already thrown $13 billion of taxpayer money down the toilet in these outrageous deals to inflict cruelty on people. These secret deals send one clear message. In Australia, some people will be punished simply because of where they were born." End quote. After allegations of Bikie involvement, one would think there would be wall-to-wall media coverage given the outrage and vitriol that covered every paper about allegations against one of the largest actually democratically organized construction unions, facing similar allegations that after 2 years have still yet to produce the damning evidence of corruption which they promised. However, you will only be able to find a handful of stories reporting on the actually documented instances of government agencies that are mentioned in relation to contractual discussions with former and current members of the underworld.
Oh, wise guy, eh?
As the AUKUS deal tries to sink its teeth into Port Kembla, the local community of Wollongong rallies together to say that there is no place for a nuclear base. On July 26, at an anti-AUKUS conference, the Australian director of ICAN, that's the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, Jem Rumold, spoke about the realities on the ground that are created when imperialist war pigs flick their wrist and splash ink on paper.
So it's just gone 80 years since the first nuclear explosion took place on First Nations land in New Mexico, the Trinity nuclear test that was made ever more famous by the Oppenheimer film. And that was the 16th of July, 1945. So right now we're in that chilling period of time between the Trinity explosion, when the successful manufacture of a nuclear weapon was proven and plans were in place to explode weapons on unknowing cities in Japan. Hiroshima and Nagasaki were accustomed to the state of war and the sound of sirens, but they had no idea what was coming and that the gates of hell would soon be opened by just two single nuclear bombs, completely incinerating both cities and most of their inhabitants, leaving the survivors to envy the dead, die slowly with totally inadequate treatment, or live with the trauma and the damage of radioactive exposure for the rest of their lives, however long that might be. Everyone is familiar with the black and white images of the rubble of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the haunted survivors with horrific burns, exposed wounds and blank eyes, and we're now seeing the same images today in colour, the rubble of Gaza and the burnt, wounded and starving Palestinian people, the children with every rib visible on their little torsos on the brink of death. And this is reality today, right now, and it's important to talk about because it's also about AUKUS and it's also about nuclear weapons. It's about the unfettered aggression of nuclear armed states. It's about Australia's political alliances and how the government will and will not respect the will of the Australian people, where it will and where it will not respect international law and human rights. And it's also about the power of the weapons industry. We need to resist following America's lead and becoming a nation that is addicted to weapons and war. So AUKUS, despite all the bright red flags, Australia is still pursuing the acquisition of nuclear-powered submarines fueled by weapons-grade, highly enriched uranium. This in particular, the HEU part of it, will undoubtedly increase regional risk, undermine non-proliferation norms, making it easier for other countries to take the same path. Australia is breaking a taboo against non-nuclear countries acquiring nuclear submarines and the HEU associated. And it also, these submarines and AUKUS flies in the face of global efforts, which Australia is also, on the other hand, involved in, or speaking about, to reduce fissile material stockpiles worldwide. Because bringing in fissile material creates more demand for fissile material. So how can you then, on the other hand, be saying, well, now we need to limit fissile material? It's just totally hypocritical. So B-52s and no nuclear weapons in Australia. That's where I'm going next. This isn't strictly part of AUKUS, but it's in the headlines a lot less, but it's a massive deal, particularly for the nuclear weapons side of things, because this the plans for Australia to host US B-52s at Tyndall in the Northern Territory in a more permanent way, with construction underway now. It's a big deal. Half the fleet of these planes are nuclear capable, the other half are only conventionally capable. And this risks breaching the South Pacific Nuclear Free Zone Treaty, the Rarotonga Treaty that Australia is a party to, because it prohibits the stationing of nuclear weapons. And I think it's pretty hard, when you look at the text of the treaty and Australia's implementing legislation, it's really hard to see how what's planned is not going to potentially involve the stationing of nuclear weapons. So we're getting legal advice and we're interested in challenging the government on this. It also means that nuclear weapons for the first time could be launched from Australia. And I'm really relying here on the excellent work of Richard Tanter and Vince Scapaccura and the report that they've come out with that is a catalogue of every single US B-52. And you can identify from these little spikes on the side of the fuselage if that plane is nuclear capable or not. So it's also likely that Australia will be supporting nuclear capable submarines in a more serious way. Including through rotating those rotating through Australia under AUKUS. So, you know, what I'm calling for, what ICAN is calling for, is for nuclear weapons to be specifically excluded from Australia, land, airspace and waters, and to reject this policy of neither confirming nor denying, which the US continues to assert and Australia continues to accept. We think that we deserve to know and to say no if there are nuclear weapons on any platforms in Australia. We are not a nuclear weapons country. We have joined almost all the treaties available to us that are about getting rid of nuclear weapons. We should not be assisting or facilitating the possession or the use of nuclear weapons. It's illegal under international law, under the Ban Treaty.
As we round out the show, the last thread we will pull on today is the global push towards austerity for the working class and the importance of building a fighting movement that can tackle the challenges that face us. Across the ditch in New Zealand, Aotearoa, there will be a multi-sector strike on the 23rd of October that will see teachers, nurses and other public sector workers walk off the job, demanding better pay, safer staffing levels and improved working conditions. The right-wing coalition government has come out and tried to slander the popular movement, saying that it is politically motivated because one of the points for striking put forward by a teachers' union was solidarity for Palestine. The highly organized strike is being managed by the unions involved, with particular care taken around the needs of students and patients, with rolling strike actions and industry-specific mechanisms being deployed in order to remain focused on the target, which is to bring the government to the table and bring wages in line with inflation. Speaking to Q&A, incoming Council of Trade Unions President Sandra Gray said, quote, "I don't understand why a minister would go out to try and divide New Zealanders. We love our teachers, we love our nurses, we love our health workers, and we know that they're struggling to keep up with their work. We know their pay is not keeping up, and she's trying to drive a wedge between people and to call into question a very legitimate right for workers to stand up and say, we want better. We want more nurses on the wards. We want more teachers in the classrooms. We deserve to have pay that keeps up with inflation, and this government should deliver it." And in responding to a question about the legitimacy of statements of solidarity with Palestine, Gray said that, quote, "It is really right and proper that workers of New Zealand express their concern about workers in Palestine that are being attacked, schools being bombed, and that there is nothing wrong with unions raising that. We should be able to raise anything we like as citizens of New Zealand with ministers when we meet them. Our concerns about our world and our concerns about our lives." These words echo throughout time and space, as the realities of our shared struggle and the need for solidarity reveal itself. To close out the show, we will listen to the Victorian Secretary of CPSU, Giselle Hanna, deliver a speech on Saturday, 4th of October at Eltham Town Square that brings together all of the threads that we have collected today.
Friends, comrades, sisters and brothers, we are rallying here today because the people of Gaza are facing devastation, facing genocide. It's been 2 years since Israel launched its genocidal campaign against the people of Gaza, masquerading as self-defense, masquerading as a plight of a forgotten people for their holy land. The truth is, the land that today we call Israel, or even what we call Palestine, that land is holy to lots and lots of people of different faiths and different languages. We could go down that path and focus on which peoples has a more righteous claim to those lands. But I'm not convinced that that's what this war is about. War is about imperialism. It's about fighting for scarce resources on a finite planet under an economic system seeking infinite growth. This is capitalism's desperate gasp for survival, and it turns once again to its oldest weapon, and that's war. History shows us that in times of crisis, the powerful will always sacrifice lives to preserve the system. But history also shows us something else, that the workers' movement has stood as a force against war and against fascism, against the destruction that flows from putting profit before people. From the strikes against conscription in World War I, to dock workers refusing to load ships for fascist regimes, to unions standing with anti-colonial struggles, workers have always had the power to resist. And here's the truth. The working class is the only force strong enough to defeat capitalism and its endless wars. We are the ones who build, who transport, who heal, who feed, who educate, who keep society running. But we're not the only ones who know that that's our power. The right wing know it too. I know that people are really frustrated that the unions have failed to take an active stand in this movement for a free Palestine and against the genocide. Workers are not inherently left-wing. They're not inherently collectivist. There is a genuine battle for the consciousness of workers, and you've seen right across the world, the ultra-right is also making their case to the workers' movement too. So the task in front of us is clear. We must convince workers that their future lies not with dictators, not with the generals, not with the charismatic leaders who maintain a system for the few at the expense of the many. Our future lies with each other, with Palestinian workers, with workers across the globe, with every person who wants to live in dignity and peace. So how do we win? We win by fighting for a world that is safe and free for everyone. We win by linking the struggles, because they're already linked. The struggle for Palestine is connected to the fight for climate justice, for refugee rights, for housing, for decent jobs, for the right to live without fear. Capitalism denies us all of this, and it tries to keep us isolated in our struggles. But when we join them together, when we see the thread that ties them all, that is how we build real power. That's why the struggle for Palestine is the struggle for the world. Because when we demand freedom for Palestine, we're demanding an end to a system that fuels war, division, and exploitation everywhere. When we stand for internationalism, we're building the only alternative to endless war. Solidarity between workers, across borders, across identities, united against those who profit from our suffering. Comrades, our task is not simple, but it is urgent. We must organise, we must educate, we must win the hearts and minds of workers to the cause of Palestine and the cause of internationalism. Because only a workers' movement that knows its own power can bring an end to imperialism, to war, and the system that breeds war. Let's fight for a world where every person can live free in dignity with justice. Let's fight for Palestine, and through that fight, let's fight for the world. Free, free Palestine! Free, free Palestine! From the river to the sea!
That's it for Stick Together this week. If you want to catch up with our program, the podcast is available at 3cr.org.au or at your favourite podcast site. You can contact the producers of the show at sticktogether3cr@gmail.com or by ringing 03 9419 8377 and leaving us a message. My name's Tobia. Remember, wherever you are, whatever you do, there is a union for you. And until next time, stick together.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.